from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio and our studios in Sacramento, this is Forum. I'm John Myers. Coming up in this hour, some of the biggest California politics stories on the horizon these days. First up, a conversation with two newly elected leaders of the California legislature. And then, a conversation with political reporters about Governor Jerry Brown's trade mission to Mexico next week, the chances of serious political ethics reform here in the state capitol in 2014, and the campaign season across California that is coming up. A Friday dive into the big stories in the world of California politics. That's coming up this hour on Forum. From KQED Public Radio and our studios in Sacramento, this is Forum. I'm John Myers, senior editor of KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Even in the era of strict term limits in the state capitol, the leadership of both houses of the legislature rarely changes hands. The outgoing leader of the state senate, for example, will have led the upper house for 6 years when he steps down this fall. Two new legislative leaders are now waiting in the wings, each of them already playing a role in the final big debates of the two-year legislative session that ends a month from now. Republican Kristen Olson of Modesto has been chosen to be the new GOP leader of the California State Assembly, and Democrat Kevin DeLeon of Los Angeles has been elected as the next president pro tem of the California State Senate. This morning, a brief conversation with each of them about their agenda and the issues facing the state, as well as some conversation with political reporters who cover the Capitol after we speak to the legislative leaders. Senator Kevin DeLeon was unavailable to speak to us this morning, but I spoke with him briefly late Thursday afternoon from Los Angeles. He's headed to Mexico next week as part of Governor Jerry Brown's trade delegation, a trip where he says the new immigration debate here in California that we've been having over the last few weeks will no doubt come up.
You know, the images from Murrieta, California specifically, were highly disturbing to see grown men and women shouting obscenities at children, to see them yelling and pounding on the windows of the buses, blocking the buses, was truly, you know, un-American. That's not who we are as a community, as a state, as a country. The issue that's before us with regards to these children, the undocumented children, is a humanitarian crisis, obviously. And I think that what has led to this, obviously, is the paralysis in Washington, D.C. Right now, Washington, D.C. Is paralyzed by gridlock. But I think that regardless of the paralysis in D.C., California has led the way. Obviously, last year, we moved forward with the driver's license. We reformed the Secure Communities Act that is currently run by Homeland Security, with the Trust Act in California. So, I mean, we don't have the full authorities, obviously, to reform immigration policy. If we did, obviously, it would be a done deal, and we would have immigration reform in the state of California, but the reality is we don't. But we're going to continue to amp up the pressure on the folks in Washington, D.C. to get the job done, because this has real, true ramifications for California, because, again, we're the eighth largest economy in the entire world. I think it's incumbent, it's absolutely critical that we unite families together, families that have been separated, children from their mothers. We've had children, I witnessed children, I spoke with children in detention centers who made the, you know, 1,000-mile journey, the trek through treacherous, you know, territories in search for their mothers who were here in California, either in the west side of Los Angeles or in Pacific Heights in San Francisco or Hillsborough or Palo Alto, you know, cleaning someone's home. So this is a really human story, but it's a human tragic story as well, too. So we're going to continue to put the pressure on our colleagues, members of Congress, to do the right thing and to get it done and get it done soon. Obviously, if they're not able to do so, then it is our hope that the president will, through an administrative, you know, action, through the executive branch, obviously, do the right thing and make the necessary changes so we can unite families and move this economy forward.
Let me ask you quickly about another chief executive, one you'll have to work with a lot as leader of the state Senate, and that's Governor Brown. And in particular, one issue that came up recently. I just want to get your thoughts on it. Some people may have heard about it. It's an issue you disagreed with him a little bit on, which was high-speed rail. You were quoted in a newspaper story. I know you know the quote, that beginning at the middle of the Central Valley was a mistake, that the valley's full of tumbleweeds, I think the quote attributed to you, where nobody lives. And then I saw you at the editorial board of the Fresno Bee last week with this very big pie. You called it a humble pie, an apology, I guess, of sorts to the valley. Tell me, do you think there's time to reconsider the details of where that train starts? Is that something you want to see the legislature or the governor tackle? What's the message?
Well, a couple of things. One is I do believe in high-speed rail. I think that we have so many countries in the world, Japan, Korea, South Korea, China, France, Germany, just to name a few, that have high-speed rail. Many industrial countries have it. We should have it in the United States, and we should clearly have it in the largest state in the country, which is California. That being said, I do believe that we can move forward with laying down track simultaneously in the Central Valley, as along with the bookends, that being San Francisco, the Bay Area, and Los Angeles. Now, I do believe strongly that the funding for the Central Valley should come from bond dollars as well as federal dollars. But cap-and-trade dollars, and that's specifically coming from auction revenues from AB 32, that those monies should be invested in the bookends. And the reason why I believe that is that part of the AB 32 goals, obviously, are immediate carbon reduction. And we have to demonstrate immediate carbon reduction goals. And I think you can do so successfully and help build the infrastructure, which is antiquated system that we have both in San Francisco and Los Angeles, to prepare for high-speed rail. I think we can do so using cap-and-trade dollars. And at the same time, we can lay down track and start the infrastructure in the Central Valley as well, too. So two separate things. You know, I'm bullish and moving forward with bond dollars as well as federal dollars for high-speed rail in the Central Valley, and also using cap and trade dollars in the bookends of San Francisco. I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's a prudent thing to do. And I think also, too, it minimizes the potential of litigation, because
you don't think we need to rethink the Central Valley as the beginning point.
No. And I think, you know, my comment at the time was sort of taken out of context and misinterpreted. I think we can move forward with construction in the Central Valley with bond dollars as well as federal dollars.
That is Democrat Kevin DeLeon, the Senate President pro tem-elect. He represents the 22nd Senate District, including Los Angeles and surrounding communities. He spoke to us late yesterday afternoon. As Kevin DeLeon prepares to lead the state Senate, a new assembly member prepares her role for leading the Republican caucus of the state assembly. Kristen Olson is a Republican representing Modesto in California's 12th Assembly District, and she joins us by phone this morning. Assemblymember Olson, good morning.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Good, thank you. You know, I've spoken to some former Republican leaders in the legislature who have likened the job of minority leader as a thankless task of herding cats. I mean, you've said you want to unify this caucus. How do you do that as leader when you take office in a few months?
You know, it certainly takes time. I plan to spend one-on-one time with each member of our caucus on a regular basis. And I think the goal will be to unify our caucus by empowering each member according to their strengths, interests, and abilities. We can be stronger as a team. We can be stronger than our super minority status if we're all working together. And I believe to do that, we have to respect the values and strengths of each member.
And so, but let me ask you, what exactly do you mean by that? Because, I mean, your members believe a lot of different things. I mean, there are a number of different opinions there. Do you try to get them to focus on just a small number of issues? I mean, in other words, that's a tough task. I think that's what has faced a lot of your predecessors, which is getting everybody unified.
Sure. And that's true in any group human dynamic, right? Large groups, there's a wide spectrum of ideas, and it's incumbent on strong leaders to bring those ideas together, to refine our message, and focus on core principles that unite us. And I truly believe we can unify our party. I actually believe we can unify Californians around core principles that will energize our state. And namely, that's by laying out a clear vision of solution-focused policies to attract good jobs, to create great schools, and a more efficient government. Those three prongs, good jobs, great schools, and a more efficient government, are the foundation of Republican core principles. And I do believe they can unify our caucus, and then other issues become on the periphery. And certainly that doesn't mean they don't need a voice at times. But my goal is to deliver consistent, focused messages and strategies that will unite us and make it clear to Californians what we stand for.
How would you, what job do you think the legislature has done? You've been in the legislature for several years now on those issues of jobs and the economy and schools. Do you see any progress? Do you think the legislature collectively has done anything on those issues in the last few years?
We have a long way to go. Certainly, if you asked every single member of the legislature, I have no doubt every single one of them would say their top priority is job creation, right? Well, if that's the case, we wouldn't continue to have 24% poverty in California. One in four families is living in poverty. That's not okay. In the San Joaquin Valley, where I was born and raised and continue to raise my family, we have double-digit unemployment. So we have a long way to spur economic growth and to allow the private sector to create jobs again that will allow families to provide for their children and for all of their needs and allow them to find good jobs right here in California. I do think we've made some progress in education reform. Educational excellence is a top priority to me, not only as a lawmaker, because I think it's key to our long-term economic success, but also as a mom. I have three kids, and I want them to be able to access a top-quality education that will set them up for success not only in school but in life. And this year, we were able to lay some groundwork toward more education reform. Through AB 215, we've now expedited the process to remove teachers from the classroom that have committed just horrific, egregious acts against children. And that really helps all teachers because, to be honest, most of our teachers are very hardworking and doing a good job. And we shouldn't let their reputation be dragged down by a few bad apples. So we're making steps in the right direction, but we need to continue down that track to make sure that we have an effective teacher in every school classroom, regardless of where a child lives and may go to school, regardless of their background. Our kids deserve that, and there's a lot more reform we need to do to get there. And at the same time, we need to continue to reinvest in education so that our students and their teachers and staff and administration have the tools and the resources they need to provide great schools.
Tell me, if you can, briefly, your impression of the way Governor Brown has worked with the legislature. You know, the woman that you are succeeding, Assemblymember Connie Conway, Republican leader from Tulare County, has often praised Governor Brown for the work he has done, talked about he's a responsible adult in the room in the state capitol. How do you see that relationship with the governor?
Yeah, one of my favorite phrases of Ms. Conway's is that she likes to channel Governor Brown's inner Republican. And certainly, you know, I look forward to continuing to work with Governor Jerry Brown. We don't agree on everything. In particular, high-speed rail is probably one of the most premier examples. But I do think he has an interest in trying to work with Republicans and Democrats to get California to a place of more fiscal stability and health. Now, if that's the case, again, I'm quick to point out the projects that he needs to abandon, like high-speed rail. I'm quick to point out that there's still more we need to do to make our public pension system solvent, but he's gone a long way toward implementing some of the reforms that are necessary. You know, really, while our problems are long-term and challenging and complex and hard to tackle, the ideas and solutions really are quite simple. We got to build bridges, we have to set common priorities, and we have to get back to basics. And I'm hopeful that in the years ahead, we'll be able to continue to work together toward policies that will revitalize California, and the cores of that has to do with jobs and schools.
Sounds like, of course, you're going to be the Republican leader in the Assembly in a few months. There's an election year. You may think you may be working with Governor Brown again. You know he's up for re-election.
He is. We are excited about this November and the election year. I've spent all week actually visiting candidates up and down our state that are running with the Republican Party, and we have a very hardworking, solution-focused group of candidates this year. I'm excited to work with them next year and looking forward to the November elections.
And do you just really quickly, Ms. Olson, since that I didn't quite put my point here, do you think your Republican candidate for governor, Neel Kashkari, can win?
I think his messages are right on. Neel Kashkari, up and down the state, is talking about the importance of creating an environment that will allow for job growth and educational excellence. Those are the two things that all Californians care about. So I think his message is right, but no question about it. It's an uphill battle. We have a long way to go in California before we prove to constituents that Republicans have winning ideas, winning policies and strategies that will benefit everyone. And our job is to articulate that to people in all parts of California. You know, for so long, I think we've resisted going into areas that may be viewed as Democratic strongholds. Well, I can tell you, I view my job as Republican leader-elect and soon to be leader of the state assembly to go to every part of California and talk with people, talk with moms, dads, small business owners, workers about the challenges they're facing and explain our goals and how we have solutions for those challenges. And we want to listen to them. We want to work with them to revitalize California, because then all of our families will benefit from that.
Kristen Olson is a Republican who represents Modesto in the 12th Assembly District, and she is the incoming Republican leader of the State Assembly. Assemblymember Olson, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, John. Have a great day.
Thank you. So you've heard the two legislative leaders in waiting at the beginning of this hour of forum and talking about their priorities and what they are looking forward on some of the issues facing the state. Both of them are going to no doubt play a role in this final month of legislative wrangling here in the state capitol. It begins in a matter of days. This is also an election season, which means the politics and government beat for those of us in the press is a busy one. And joining me in studio now, two of my colleagues to talk a little bit about that, my colleagues in the State Capitol Press Corps, as we discuss some of the interesting items to watch in the weeks to come. And we welcome your calls and questions about this political season. Jessica Calafatti is a state government politics reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. David Siders is a political writer for the Sacramento Bee. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
So let's talk a little bit. You've heard Senator De Leon and Assemblymember Olson here. I want to talk a little bit about this changing of the guard and how they move their agendas forward, and also how they work with the governor, because I asked Ms. Olson that in particular in an election season here. The people they are replacing have been in position for a very long time. And these are tough issues. I mean, what do you think is tops on their challenge? Jessica, begin with you.
Well, legislative leaders in both parties are keenly aware that the governor is a powerful force in Sacramento and that they're going to have to work with him. It's difficult to imagine a reality where they could work around him. And I think for Kevin De Leon, he's going to be following in Daryl Steinberg's footsteps. He's learned a lot from him over the years already. And for Kristen Olson, she's a fresh face with some new ideas that differ from Connie Conway and others in her party.
David Siders, one of the things we heard both of these legislative leaders in waiting, as I call them, talk about is high-speed rail. And the governor has fair to say that that's one of the things the governor has not been able to sell very well. You look at the polling. You look at what's going on inside the Capitol. We saw the budget. We saw a big fight over the funding. De Leon talked about that a little bit, money from the cap and trade program. Is that something that we might see come back up? I mean, and what has the governor got to do?
Well, I think it's a continuous issue. But it's interesting. I think the high-speed rail and cap and trade debate maybe speaks to the relationship between the governor and the lawmakers, that while they are resistant and say, just as De Leon did a minute ago, his concerns about where cap and trade funding should be used, you see their votes in the end still supporting that in the budget. And Brown, I think, to get that through, really didn't have to give up very much. You saw him move a little bit towards other Democrats' demands. But my view of high-speed rail and cap and trade in the last budget debate was it was really a leverage point for Democrats on their other concerns. I don't think they thought they could move Brown off the project. And in fact, they haven't. So, yeah, he has concerns in the court. He has concerns with funding. Legislatively, I'm not sure that's the top of his three concerns, although clearly it's a consistent issue.
And I mean, and the Brown administration clearly won a small victory in court just within the last day with the path through the Pacheco Pass in the Central Valley, an appeals court upholding that. But there are legislators who would like to have a second look at some of this. I mean, we saw them push him about the Palmdale to Burbank section during the legislative budget debate. And there are people who want to take a second look at this. I mean, this is still a tough issue.
Absolutely. And Kevin De Leon is expected to push the High-Speed Rail Authority to start that Burbank to Palmdale section right away and work on it while the authority works on the Central Valley section.
And not focus on the tumbleweed so much. That was the quote he gave to the Los Angeles Times, which he is walking back, as you heard, very quickly.
That's right. And the High-Speed Rail Authority is set to meet on August 12th. And it's very likely that they're going to formally adopt a plan to start work on that Southern California section, which is what Kevin De Leon would like to see.
Let's talk about a couple of the other things that are going on. David Siders from Sacramento Bee, you're traveling with the governor next week on his trade mission to Mexico.
Yes, what should by high-speed rail.
Yeah, not by high-speed rail. What should we be looking for? What do you think are the narratives or the themes out of this mission to Mexico, which comes at a very interesting time with the relationship between California and its Latin American neighbors?
Yeah, I think Brown is probably not going to discuss immigration so much or crime or some of those other controversies. But this is an interesting opportunity for the governor on the environment. We saw him go to China last year and talk about the environment. And while Mexico is nowhere near the emitter that China is, he, I guess the other day laid out what he thinks is his roadmap in his effort to be a global diplomat on the environment. And that is that he thinks Mexico is important to Latin America when they get together, when those nations get together in Lima at the end of the year. And then that meeting is a key step in the way to next year's meeting in Paris, where there's supposed to be a new global treaty. So I'm not sure how much influence a governor, even one with Jerry Brown's credentials on the environment, can have on global policy on the environment. But we're seeing him express this as his roadmap to how he thinks that California and these agreements he's forming with other states and countries, even though they're non-binding MOUs, could maybe have some influence.
And yet there are dangers here. I mean, as we know, Jessica Calafatti, we looked at a poll this week where Californians still support these policies towards climate change, unless you ask the question if it's going to cost you money out of your pocketbook, and then they get a little bit reluctant.
That's right. The PPIC found that more than 70% of Californians support reductions in carbon and fuels, but if that means higher gas prices, then support goes down to something in the 40% range.
We are speaking with two of my colleagues in the State Capitol Press Corps here this morning, talking about some of the items on the agenda, both in the political world and the Capitol world in this election season. We're going to give you a moment to weigh in on this conversation here in a moment, either online or by phone. As we come to the bottom of the hour, I want to ask you here quickly, what are you looking for when the legislature returns next week most? What do you think is really one of the bigger issues that you might be watching, Jessica Calafatti?
I cover the Silicon Valley area and the Bay Area more broadly, and we're focused on Senator Leno's kill switch bill, which would require anti-theft technology in all cell phones sold in California starting next year. And I'm also following a bill by Senator Bell called Audrey's Law, which would strengthen penalties against juvenile sex offenders.
So do you, on the kill switch one really quickly, is that one likely to move forward at this point? I mean, the industry has been trying to kill, no pun intended, that bill for quite a while.
That's right. And there was a compromise struck earlier this year that allowed the bill to move forward. And Senator Leno necessarily got Apple and Microsoft on board. That was huge. And now it looks like it will move forward. Audrey's Law already had a compromise struck earlier this year, and it will likely move forward in its current form as well.
And let me give you a chance to join the discussion here after the break. If you'd like to join us, give us a call. We're talking state politics, what's coming up at the state capitol. I also want to talk about the election season ahead, the race between Jerry Brown and Neel Kashkari, and other races that we are watching across California with two of my political reporter colleagues, Jessica Calafatti from the San Jose Mercury News, David Siders from the Sacramento Bee. You can call us to join the conversation at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them online at kqed.org/forum. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm John Myers in our State Capitol Bureau in Sacramento today, talking a little bit about the political year ahead. The California legislature returns here to Sacramento in just about a week and a half to complete its work on a two-year session. It's also an election year. There's a lot going on. Statewide offices, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, all up for election this year. A couple of my fellow political reporters in California joining me for this conversation here for this half hour, Jessica Calafatti, state government politics reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, and David Siders, political writer for the Sacramento Bee, both in studio with me. When we went to the break, we talked a little bit about the election season to come, and I want to talk about the race for governor just for a moment before we go to some of our callers. Jerry Brown, Neil Kashkari, the Republican newcomer, a new poll out this week, again showing Brown in a commanding lead, 52% support in that poll. And then we also saw a campaign finance report from the governor just yesterday with a lot of money in the bank. Is this I don't want to, you know, this is kind of the danger. Is the race over? And I mean, and maybe more precisely, is the question now, David Siders, do you think about how Brown maintains his footing? I mean, is it all about Brown losing more than Kashkari finding a way to win?
Well, to call the race over, I think, is premature. Anything can happen in a long, there's a long season before November, but clearly he has a 20-point lead is commanding. I think what's striking is that on that financial report is not that he's raised $22.5 million and has that in the bank, but that in the primary season, which he won handily in that election, he only spent, less than $300,000 on that entire 6 months. So clearly he's the front runner here, but Kashkari's making a game of it. You know, we heard from Kristen Olson. She said he has the right ideas and he clearly wants to be an idea candidate, somebody who has maybe more moderate views than some Republican candidates for governor in the past, and he thinks that's the way to move the party. I'm almost surprised he's not in studio today, given how many radio appearances and interviews and guest hosting jobs he's done in the past 3 weeks. So he's putting his foot out there.
And he's trying to, fair to say, too, he is trying to pivot away from a lot of the traditional issues. I mean, he was putting out press releases this week talking about how he marched in a gay pride parade. I mean, and trying to get attention from that. It's a definite pivot away from the primary race where, it was a battle over conservatism, putting out flyers across the state, calling himself a conservative Republican. But these numbers, they're daunting. I mean, 29% registration for Republicans in California, it's hard.
Well, The pivot is not, the pivot goes two ways, right? You can look at the candidate either from what his rhetoric and what he says and does outside of paid advertising, and then you can look at what he does in paid advertising. And certainly in the primary, the paid advertising was geared towards heavily conservative, four for four conservative voters in conservative areas. And that's where you saw him carrying the axe and hatcheting the budget and calling himself a conservative Republican. But you have to remember that when he came out as a candidate, he volunteered that he voted for Barack Obama in 2008. He volunteered, these moderate positions he has on gay marriage. He was going to homeless shelters and talking about the poor. So in some ways, it's coming back for Neil. And I don't think that, as far as pivoting, I think he needs any exposure he can get and will go on any show and do any event that he can. So if it's a gay pride parade or an alien parade or whatever it is, I think you could expect to see him there.
Jessica, you were going to weigh in. I mean, the challenge here, if you're Jerry Brown, of course, is to navigate some of these legislative issues we've been talking about, not stumble on something, whether it's high-speed rail or a water bond or something else.
Absolutely. And Neil Kashkari has been hammering Jerry Brown on some of those issues. He says every single time he's out there in public that he doesn't support the bullet train. He calls it the crazy train. He doesn't support Jerry Brown's work in restoring California's economy. He thinks the schools are in terrible shape. And if that resonates with voters, then maybe he picks up a little bit of steam moving forward.
This is a political season, and it raises lots of questions, too, about the tone of politics. And one of our callers, I think, has a bit of a comment on those kind of issues. Stan in Campbell this morning. Good morning, Stan.
Hello. How are you? Thank you for taking my call. Let me preface this a little bit. The man was just talking about how you could judge Kashkari on his political ads or his rhetoric. Well, we could also say judge him on his job performance. See, my question is this, and it lends itself to that, which is at what point does infighting and dirty politics become treason? Because all this stuff is happening at the public's expense. And I would like y'all to really take that question seriously.
David Sanders, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, there's a blowback here. I think what Stan, one of what I kind of hear from Stan is the blowback of the way politics works and the debate. It makes people feel as though these are not people who have serious ideas, and Brown will have to engage at some point. He can't just govern. He's going to have to campaign, and the tone of that campaign matters to people, I think, like Stan.
I would expect Brown, when he does engage, to hardly engage Kashkari at all, and so I don't think that you'll see much pushback coming against Kashkari, but more just a promotional effort or promotional advertisement, I guess, of his own campaign. It's interesting about, you know, whether that race with Neil Kashkari and Tim Donnelly got so negative, and I'm not sure that it was unusually negative, but certainly Kashkari was taking shots at Donnelly at the end with conservative voters. And his opponent or his boosters were as well. I don't know that it got to the level that we've seen other campaigns get to.
Yeah.
Certainly, this campaign is more tepid so far than the campaign between Jerry Brown and Meg Whitman. Meg Whitman outspent Neil Kashkari by tens of millions of dollars, and I'm curious to see now moving forward with Neil Kashkari having so much less money than Meg Whitman did in 2010. In 2008, how we move forward.
So clearly there are a lot of issues facing that'll become part of that campaign. And also, as we've talked about, some of these issues come back to the Capitol in a couple of weeks. Harvey is on the line from Berkeley. And Harvey, I think you've been talking about high-speed rail. I have a curious question about it.
Yes. Hello, John, Jessica, and David. Well, I feel that I'll start by just saying that California's aqueduct system in the Central Valley needs to be repaired and rebuilt, and because of saltwater intrusion and earthquake preparedness. And at the same time, they can cover it with a photovoltaic, a solar panel canopy that cover appropriate sections with a photovoltaic canopy that can supply the electricity needed for the high-speed rail. So right there, because California Central Valley is so rich in sunshine, this would be the perfect source of clean, renewable electricity to power the high-speed rail, and it would make it feasible and possible. This would also create an incredible amount of jobs for people in the Central Valley, both repairing the aqueduct system and building the high-speed rail. So I think that's the way to go, and especially at this time, with diminishing electricity from hydroelectric dams. We certainly don't want to use electricity from Diablo Canyon. We want to close that down because of the big one, the possible potential of a Fukushima-like disaster. So I say once again, power the high-speed rail with California Central Aqueduct System, photovoltaic system.
Okay. Harvey, thank you. Harvey's idea, maybe we'll forward that on to the governor, who could probably use a few good ideas, matching a couple of things there the governor's been working on. Jessica Califani, let me talk a little bit about water. And the water bond, one of the big tasks left for this legislature in its final month here in Sacramento is to figure out whether they can rework the water bond that's on the ballot, an $11 billion measure that was the product of negotiation back in 2009 and 2010, in a very different era in the Capitol. The governor has said he wants a smaller bond. Water is never easy. What do you think the odds are? I mean, because without doing anything, that $11 billion proposal remains on the ballot.
Absolutely. And the PBIC found this week that support for the water bond, the current water bond, is 51% among likely voters, but that support goes up 8 percentage points if the bond is made smaller. And I think lawmakers are aware of that, and they're going to be working hard and working quickly when they come back from their recess on putting together a package that everyone is satisfied with. But it's difficult to do that because water politics in California stretch from north to south and across the party lines.
We are talking both about issues in this California political season and issues facing the legislature when they return to Sacramento. Again, if you'd like to join the discussion, you can call us at toll-free 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, or you can post them on our Facebook page or at kqed.org/forum. Let me, David Siders, I want to ask you a little bit about how you think Jerry Brown will have to navigate some of the bills that will be put on his desk by the legislature in the coming month. We have watched him through these 3 years in true Brown terms, paddle to the left, paddle to the right in the political spectrum. For instance, on guns and gun legislation in 2013, he pretty much tried to split the difference in terms of more restrictions that Democrats wanted him to do. Talk a little bit. I mean, he's even got some of those particular measures that could come to his desk again on gun control. The governor's political philosophy is kind of fascinating here in terms of how he deals with the legislature. I mean, clearly there is a much more liberal streak in that body than seems to exist in the way the governor carries out his job.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think the governor was a great unknown when it came in, how he would approach this legislation. But it's turned out that at least as far as some of the more conservative interests are concerned, the Chamber of Commerce, for example, he's done fairly well by them. He's vetoed most of their what they call the job killer bills over the years. And then, as you say, he paddles both ways. He gives a victory on occasion to his more liberal constituencies. Last year, it would have been the minimum wage hike bill that was the only job killer bill or so-called job killer bill that he signed last year. As much as he complains about the legislation, though, his veto rate overall is pretty small.
Historically and in the last few years.
Indeed. And so, but because he's so good at this image forming and these public, I guess this view in the public of him as a curmudgeonly and conservative kind of governor, he gets away with complaining about the hundreds of bills that come to his desk while signing, pretty well most of them.
And seems to work, Jessica Calafatti, behind the scenes pretty well. I mean, in terms of getting the kinds of things he wants, pushing things away that he doesn't have to veto because he's worked behind the scenes, getting a little more of what he wants. And now when you look at water bond or this talk of a school bond, I mean, these are more issues that you're probably going to see the governor getting what he wants more in an election year rather than being faced with a very public debate of having to veto something and having a Democratic infighting.
Absolutely. And several weeks ago, the legislature floated a water bond that was smaller than the $11 billion bond, but much larger than what it turned out Jerry Brown wanted to see. And that's a roughly $6 billion bond. And once that $6 billion number was made public, the legislature stopped short of introducing another bond that was any larger than that. So really how the governor feels about these things can influence lawmakers, even if he's not coming out at a public event and saying, this is what I demand.
Back to your calls now. Let's go to Paul in San Jose. Paul, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just a question, since the three of you live and breathe the news, how do you think the high-speed rails, how realistic is the high-speed rail gonna in California? Because I'm reading, and when I have time to read the news, that there's mounting opposition and people talking about it. Governor Brown is a fabulous politician, and he's for it. But, how realistic do you think it is? Do you think does it have legs? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay, Paul, thank you. Jessica Calafatti, I mean, talk don't know how much of a crystal ball any of us as reporters absolutely have about what's going to happen, but you've spent some time watching high-speed rail. I mean, what do you assess its viability at this point?
I think high-speed rail really turned a corner with the cap-and-trade budget deal that's going to send 25% of all cap-and-trade fees that come into the state to the project. And I spoke with some companies this past week about their new interest in the project because of that budget deal. And even though there's only, $250 million coming to the project this next fiscal year, the fact that funding is going to be regular, it's going to be consistent, and it hopefully, in their minds, can't be touched by the legislature is huge. And we may see some private investment in the project.
And even with that being said, the governor and the project continue to face problems in Washington because the project continues to rely on federal money that we haven't seen any sign that any more money would come. The Obama administration may support it, but Republicans are in control in the House, and Kevin McCarthy, the new incoming majority leader, of the House of Representatives, has said no way, no how.
Absolutely. The project is by no means out of the woods. They're having trouble, as you said, getting any more funding from the federal government. Right now, there's $3.2 billion in the bank, but the state had expected much more than that, and it's unclear if that money will ever come. And at the state level, there are court challenges to using any of the bond money. That's close to $10 billion that may or may not be used for the project.
Jessica Calafatti, a writer for the San Jose Mercury News, and David Siders from the Sacramento Bee, joining me talking about California politics and the agenda of Jerry Brown and the legislature. Let's go back to your calls. Catherine on the phone this morning from Sacramento.
Yes, good morning. I really relish the opportunity to comment. I had intended that our United Nations Association chapter support a carbon tax that Daryl Steinberg was proposing until he lost three senators from his quorum to some kind of corruption. But the carbon tax is the key to full cost pricing on what is doing all the damage, the burning of oil. And if California could get up from the 40% interest in supporting a gas tax increase, we might lead the way next year in Paris for the UN deliberations on worldwide climate change, which is just substantial. And risky business is the new report out by three prominent wealthy men here in the United States, showing the damage that climate change is doing all over the country. So what do you think about a carbon tax being proposed and maybe Brown even supporting us for a change?
Well, David Siders, I mean, we know that Daryl Steinberg, the leader of the state Senate, did talk about a carbon tax earlier this year and has somewhat abandoned it, as the caller points out, somewhat because of the membership of the Senate, which I want to talk about in a moment. But the governor never got on board with something like that. Well, and I was going to say, one of the challenges for the governor here is continuing this this narrative of climate change and these global problems, but also picking and choosing the way that he approaches the issue and finding people who sometimes find him inconsistent on the issue.
Well, sure. And on the carbon tax issue in particular, instead what we have is, you know, transportation fuels coming under the cap in January, and the governor is under tremendous pressure from oil interests to delay that part of the program. They say it will increase gas prices. I don't think the administration will. But on other issues, as you say, Brown has taken a divergent view. Fracking comes to mind. He's been protested and heckled. The protesters interrupted his speech at the Democratic convention this year. And so, you know, activists, I think he's well regarded nationally as an environmental leader, but activists have some serious problems with him on some of these issues at home, not only fracking, but also the Environmental Quality Act.
Let me pivot from the policy to the politics of getting something like a carbon tax or anything else through the legislature, which I think would have been a very heavy lift, even if some of the scandal issues had not happened in the Capitol. But I want to talk about that. Jessica Calafatti, if you could, for a moment. The leadership in the state Senate has been talking about ethics reform in 2014 after three of their members, Ron Calderon from the Los Angeles area, Rod Wright from Los Angeles, and then Leland Yee from San Francisco, all suspended for various reasons, a scandal, corruption in the cases of two, and where Rod Wright lived, whether he had perjured himself about his residence in Los Angeles. And then we had issues about lobbyists and fundraisers. Democrats have talked a lot about that. Does that legislation make it to the governor? Where does that legislation stand at this point?
I think some of those bills do make it to the governor, but what I found earlier this month is that bills that had the most teeth have been watered down, and it gives legislators an opportunity to say we're taking ethics reform seriously when in reality the pieces of the bills that would have imposed the most stringent penalties on their work in Sacramento were taken out.
And in an election year, does that present a problem?
It could. So far, I don't think I haven't heard from voters, really, that they think the legislature is not doing its due diligence on ethics reform. In fact, there's a huge package of bills that a few dozen, or not a few dozen, but maybe a dozen that could be considered ethics reform bills. If we happen to have another lawmaker brought up on ethics charges or corruption charges, rather, I think it would become a huge problem. But right now, lawmakers are sort of able to move forward without taking this too seriously.
Let me go back to the calls and David in San Francisco, who's been very patient on the line. Good morning, David.
Oh, yeah. Morning, John and your guest. You know, I was interested in, back in 1996, and that's now 18 years ago, the famous deregulation of electricity happened in California, and that set Enron loose on California. So we finally got Arnold and the politicians to admit that they stole $71 billion, and we never got it back. We never got it back from Bush. We never got it back from Arnold. And people in California have been putting solar on their roofs for years and expecting to make money, but that famous deregulation bill is a scam because you never get cash. You only get credits. And if you overproduce electricity, it goes onto the grid, it gets sold, but it gets sold by the grid, and you never get cash. Your credits then expire after 2 years, so you may get free electricity yourself, but you're going to be producing electricity and somebody else is going to make money from it. So 18 years of this scam has gone on, and I'd like to find out when this is going to get fixed. When can we get a feed-in tariff, which is going to actually pay people cash for producing electricity on their roofs and through wind power and whatnot?
David, thank you for the question. I don't know that any of us can answer with any definitive answers here about when those kind of policies would change. If I might, and I apologize, David, I have to somewhat pivot to a broader point because you ask a very specific policy question, but. Safe to say that is it not, David Siders, that a second term of Jerry Brown raises a lot of questions about what he could do, how broad his agenda would be. Would he tackle larger things? He's talked about global warming, but David raises a call. Could he talk about the way that we use energy in California? In other words, the agenda of a fourth term for a governor like Brown could be wide open because there's a legacy issue. Then there's a guy who can't appear before the voters again in that job. I mean, and we don't really know what those things could be. I mean, it could be the sky's the limit for a guy like Brown if he wins in November.
Certainly, that's the hope of his supporters and the fear of Republicans. But you're right, we don't know. And one of the striking things about the governor is when he announced his reelection plans a few months ago, that's normally where you would hear a politician lay out a vision or an agenda for their reelection and for the next term. And what the governor offered at that point was, frankly, a caretaker-like approach to the next term. And I'm not sure anybody believes that he will only be a caretaker. I think there are things he definitely wants to do, but it's entirely unclear what that agenda might include.
One of our listeners, James in Berkeley, wrote in to ask a question. It's an open-ended question, but I've got a couple of political reporters sitting here with me, so let's talk just kind of the bottom line of politics. James asked, does a politician risk their political life if they spend time and money talking about paying for public services? There are many public services that need fiscal support, but if the electorate votes against taxes, the infrastructure deteriorates. Why don't politicians talk more about paying for what you get and some honesty in that? And that goes to maybe even the gubernatorial campaign or legislative campaigns about trying to get this reconciliation. And we've talked about this in California a lot about paying for the services you want. The electorate wants the services, but they don't want to pay for them. Is that kind of honesty impossible in this era? Do people kind of beat people up too much? David Siders? Well,
I think Jerry Brown is an example of a politician who, because he is so far ahead in the polls and because he has been so safe this term, has been able to address this. You've heard him at press conference after press conference, even when he was announcing cuts early in the administration, talking about the value of government. And in a direct way that your listener is right, politicians normally do not do. But he would talk about how government is not some vague entity, but is rather the people who provide services and do X, Y, and Z. And I think that was unusual and only because of the freedom he has with his high popularity and good poll numbers.
Of course, having said that, the Prop 30 taxes, for example, they were temporary. And they're one, if there is a criticism of Brown's first term since he's back, is that some of the fixes are not long-term enough. And would he deal with those in a second term, structural issues of taxes and funding? And is there any appetite in the legislature for those issues? I mean, we do have, I want to point out quickly, we do have a legislature that is starting to become dominated by people who will be in office longer through the change in term limits. Is there an appetite for systemic structural change? Are we hearing anybody talk about that? Any of our new legislative leaders? Anyone?
I think there is some appetite for potentially higher taxes among legislators. And what Jerry Brown did with Prop 30 was he said on the campaign trail, I promise not to raise taxes on the voters unless they agree to raise them on themselves. And that's exactly what happened there. So he didn't break a promise, but in fact, he was still able to increase those taxes for schools. Now, in the next term, there's going to need to be some kind of resolution with Prop 30. Do we continue or do we stop?
As we come to the top of the hour here and wrap up this conversation, one other question from a listener. Michael writes in to say there was a lot of discussion about environmental review reform, CEQA, before that Jerry Brown talked about, the landmark environmental review law in California. What happened to that? Is that David Sider, something that maybe comes back in a final Jerry Brown term if he wins? I mean, he has stopped talking about that issue somewhat in 2014.
Well, I'm not sure we even need to look that far ahead. I mean, you talk to environmentalists, and they're concerned that on any given day, they're concerned that in the next 12 hours, a bill will drop that will try to have a CEQA exemption that the governor might look favorably upon. And as you know, the governor famously said, I've never seen a CEQA exemption I don't like or don't want to pass.
So that could perhaps be one of those issues. We always talk about it in the final month of a legislative session. Things pop up in the dead of night. We could see, possibly, you think, maybe. Not that we're going to, for sure, but that's one of those issues that could pop up, a reform of CEQA, a change of CEQA that Brown could wade into.
Clearly, I think the potential's there.
Yeah. As we wrap up here quickly, Jessica Califatti, anything else we should be watching for this final month? I mean, you've talked about particular bills there. Any sleeper issues out there?
The one that comes to mind is the tunnel project, and we haven't heard anything about that recently, and I don't think Jerry will be bringing it up before the election, but it's still something he supports strongly.
Delta water tunnels, that could be one as well. A lot to watch in the coming month here in Sacramento with the state legislature, and then, of course, on the campaign trail from that. My thanks to our guests here, Jessica Califatti from the San Jose Mercury News, David Siders from the Sacramento Bee, and joining us earlier, the incoming president pro tem of the state Senate, Kevin De Leon, and the incoming Republican leader of the Assembly, Kristen Olson. Coming up in our next hour, more discussions on what's happening here in Sacramento. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.